Before we kick off the show, if you're a fan of History Hack, please do what you can to support the show. We completely get that not everyone is able or willing to dig into their pockets. Times are hard, but by dropping a like, subscribing on Twitter and YouTube, and importantly, leaving a review wherever you get your podcasts, you can help the program grow and reach more people. If you're interested in becoming a supporter, go to patreon.com/historyhack, where you'll find perks from secret Facebook groups to early release material. If you just want to leave us a one-off tip, go to ko-fi.com/historyhack. The links are in the description. And whatever form your kind support takes, know that we are massively grateful. Enjoy the show.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of History Hack. This is going to be so fascinating today, and I guess it has a lot of resonance for what you're seeing journalists do right now on the television in the Ukraine, because we have with us Julian Mannion, who was a journalist specialising in international stories, and he covered the Falklands War for Thames Television and was a foreign correspondent for ITN. Julian, welcome.
Thank you. Yes, hello.
Should we just dive right in at the deep end if we can? How did you end up in the back of a Ford Falcon with a gun against your head?
Well, we were sent, as the crisis in the South Atlantic grew, to Buenos Aires to try to cover the war, or the crisis as it then was, from the Argentine side. And we arrived very shortly after they landed their troops on the islands, a couple of days after that, and went about our business of trying to compile weekly reports for Thames Television's TVI programme, as it then was, about what was taking place. You'll recall that things really became deadly serious with the sinking of the Belgrano, the Argentine warship, and then the destruction by Exocet missile of the British warship HMS Sheffield. And a few days after that, on the 12th of May, I and my crew, which consisted of a cameraman, Ted Adcock, and a sound recordist, Trevor Hunter, who sadly has very recently died, went to the foreign ministry in an attempt to get a brief interview with the foreign minister, Nicanor Costa Mendes, who was actually one of the principal activists and supporters of the Argentine seizure of the Falklands. He was really a hardliner. And Costa Mendes refused to speak to us, and we therefore left the foreign ministry, wondering what we were going to send to London that week, and got in the car, which we were using, started driving away from the foreign ministry, whereupon another vehicle cut straight across us. I got out in an attempt to find out what was going on, and found myself immediately staring at an automatic pistol, while a couple of extremely tough men grabbed me and propelled me physically into the rear well of this Ford Falcon car, the Ford Falcon being the sort of signature vehicle of the Argentine secret police. And I was then driven slowly and deliberately with a cloth over my head and a pistol in my head, as it turned out of Buenos Aires. Though I didn't know it immediately, the same thing happened to Ted and Trevor. And eventually we all found ourselves in a open field outside Buenos Aires.
May I ask, how old were you at the time?
How old I was?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. Well, I was born in 1950s, and this took place in 1982. So I think I was 31.
It's just like to be that young and be going through. We'll talk about what happened next. How hostile had they been up to that point with you? Because, I mean, this must have been relatively terrifying. I guess it's your job, and it's you took this job, and it's what you did. But how terrifying was it, sort of going into Buenos Aires as the enemy?
Well, I mean, at that moment, obviously, it was absolutely terrifying. And the most terrifying thing was the powerlessness that you feel, because it became immediately apparent that one was in the hands of people who knew what they were doing, in the sense that they'd done this before, as part of the dirty war in which the Argentine military suppressed left-wing opposition in the country. And the thing which really brought it home to me as we set off in this vehicle, I mean, in my case, as I say, lying in the rear wheel, the rear well of the car, was the fact that one of these characters produced from his pocket a couple of leather thongs, which were specifically designed in this pre-electronic age to link the sort of toggle switch on the top of the passenger doors to the handle which opened the doors. In other words, to link the locking mechanism to the handle to make it impossible for anybody to, any victim, as it turned out, to kick their way out. And at that point, one realised that these people had done it before. As it turned out, we were in deep trouble.
What kind of threat did they think you posed?
Well, I don't think it's quite like that. I mean, Argentina was a different sort of society to anything that we have experienced in this country for a very long time, in the sense that the security forces included these semi-secret and in some cases secret branches of the secret police. And there were separate branches, like, for example, the Naval Secret Police. And in this case, as it turns out, a paramilitary group working for what was called the 601st Intelligence Battalion of the Army. These people, as I said, had gained extraordinary power during the period of the Dirty War, as it was called, and had suppressed the opposition by the simple process of kidnapping people in quite large numbers, torturing them, extracting information from them, and then kidnapping and murdering the next person in the list, if you see what I mean. And the fate of many, if not most, of those who fell into their hands was to be, as it was called, disappeared. The victims were called the desaparecidos, the disappeared. In most cases, had physically disappeared by the process of being dumped. Some of them in the South Atlantic, some of them in rivers in Argentina, some of them just left in fields. These people into whose hands one had fallen had themselves killed, it transpired, large numbers of people in this dirty war.
They did put you through a mock execution, didn't they?
Yes. What happened was that, as I say, we found ourselves in this very large open field, together with a number of men with guns. And they instructed us to take our clothes off, barring our underpants, which we were told to keep on, then to turn around and walk away from them. And at this moment, one of these gentlemen produced from the boot of one of their cars an automatic rifle. And it should be said that I've recently discussed this with our cameraman, Ted Adcock, exchanging memories of this dreadful event, which helped me write the book, in fact. And basically, both of us, and I think Trevor as well, thought that our number was up. We started walking, I don't know if you hear the gun that goes off that kills you, perhaps not, but we were certainly expecting to be shot. But in fact, what happened was that instead of hearing anything like that, we heard the sound of tires on soil. When we looked around, when we eventually dared to look around, we saw that our captors had gone. And we were on our own, virtually naked, in a field in the middle of Buenos Aires, in the middle of Argentina, a country at war with Britain.
To even ask you how you felt at that point, it's redundant, isn't it? That's got to be, I mean, torture in a way, isn't it?
One felt elated at having survived.
Yeah.
After the elation, there was a certain concern as to what one did now, where one was, because of course we hadn't the slightest idea where we were. It turned out that we were outside a town called Pilar, which is a place where quite a number of the victims of the Dirty War had been dumped, just dumped in the fields, you know. But we didn't know any of that. What we did was we started walking, and we eventually ran into a farmer with a tractor and a trailer who looked at us. He spoke a bit of English. He started laughing, and he said, "Today," he said, "is my birthday, and I wasn't expecting to get three naked Englishmen for my birthday," which I thought was quite witty on his part. And he then took us to the police station, where I found myself attempting to persuade the chief of police that we were not, in fact, as he believed, British commandos on a secret mission, somehow separated from our clothing, but journalists.
I mean, the only possible motivation for their actions really is to scare you, isn't it? It's a warning.
It's very unclear what the precise motivation was, though quite a lot of light about this is shed in American documents that have now been released and which were basic research material for my book. If the idea was to scare us, they certainly succeeded in that. But I should say that one of the documents that was released, which there was a CIA report, Central Intelligence Agency, from their staff in Buenos Aires to the headquarters in Langley, Virginia, a couple of weeks before this kidnapping, in which, while as were the first the political confrontation and then the war with Britain began. And this document describes how their sources, which were evidently very good, inside the 601st Intelligence Battalion, had reported that this unit was preparing to murder, to use the term disappear, which the document helpfully explains means meant murder, some 500 British residents of Argentina in the event that the war turned really nasty, which of course was taking place at that time. And it also said that they might well murder a number of Americans. Now, we also know that, pardon me, the British cabinet was aware of this warning and afterwards said that the way we had been treated illustrated the risks that the British community in Argentina now faced. A further American document suggests that, in fact, our kidnapping may have been designed to sabotage any moves towards peace which were currently going on, because there were signs at that stage that Galtieri was beginning to wobble. You know, he was under massive pressure. The British fleet had assembled and was ready to unload our troops onto the islands to take them back. The inadequacies of the Argentine military had already been revealed to some extent. And there were signs that he was wobbling. But the suggestion is that this kidnapping was designed to throw a spanner in those works.
What happened to you afterwards? Let's talk about, you had an interview with President Galtieri. That's Argentina's dictator. What was the mood like in that interview, considering that his henchmen have just pretended to kill you?
Well, I mean, this came about that evening, very late that night, in fact, after the interior minister, with whom we managed to get in, our colleague in Buenos Aires had managed to get in touch to report our kidnapping. After we managed to reach him from the police station, he sent a limousine, in fact, to pick us up and bring us back to Buenos Aires. And we were then told that President Galtieri himself wished to receive us that night. Now, Galtieri operated very late at night, and I think it must have been at least 11 p.m. by the time we got there, to the Casa Rosada. This is the so-called Pink Palace, which was the seat of Argentine government. And he received us in a sort of galleried hall on the upper floor. And with the help of, we'd lost all our television equipment, it should be said, along with our clothing. Of course, we did have a change of clothes with us, but we lost all our television equipment in the kidnapping. But with the help of Argentine television, who were there, we were able to film, pardon me, an interview with General Galtieri, which, of course, the first question was, General, who kidnapped us? Who's responsible for this?
Mm.
And to which his answer was, that it was un grupo muy reducido, a very small group, he said, that is determined to prevent peace. So actually, it may well be that he was telling the truth, you know.
I can't imagine. And so at the point where they say to you, oh, you've been summoned by the Argentine dictator. I mean, as a journalist, brilliant. As a person right then, having just been through that, you can't have been feeling that at that point.
Well, I mean, look, you know, like quite a number of others, I was in this business because I wanted to be. I don't have any complaints. And the chance to meet Galtieri in the centre of this crisis with Britain was an extraordinary opportunity. And happily, Galtieri himself saw it just as a sort of handshake and appear on Argentine television, shaking our hands, and then get on to the next thing. But happily, we were able to get an interview with him, about 20 minutes on film. And that ran the following night on TENS television and indeed throughout the network in Britain.
Let's talk about the real reason why you were kidnapped, because it's actually some part of something far more complex, wasn't it?
Well, I think I've described that, which is that we obviously don't have a precise and exact reason for it.
Yeah.
Because in particular, though we now know the name of the person who was leading the team that kidnapped us, because his name is in the American documents, which I've described. And indeed, I spent quite a lot of time researching this gentleman and finding out about his, I'm afraid, very bloodstained personal record. He died in 1997, and therefore he's not available to be asked. And there are still a couple of people alive who may well have been among our kidnappers, but they are serving long prison terms and are not talking to, even if they were given the opportunity, to people like me. So we're left with the speculation of the Americans, of the CIA, that this may have been connected with an attempt basically to sabotage any peace negotiations. And indeed, after the war, an Argentine general was put in charge of conducting an inquiry into the war. And amongst the many things he deals with is our kidnapping, which he said happened at a very unfortunate moment and was extremely counterproductive in negotiations. So, you know, there may be some truth in what the Americans, American documents said.
Just how much unrest was there in the country prior to the Falklands War to lead to this kind of response? Was this friction with the left-wing opposition, was it real, or is it just like a cover to remove any kind of dissent?
No, it was very extremely real. I mean, the military coup took place in 1976. Prior to that, there were already vigorous left-wing revolutionary groups attempting to topple the Peronist regime which existed before and to create general chaos, which they were very successful in doing. And the military came to power on the back of this, saying that they would restore order. And basically, they made it clear that the way to restore order was to arrest and more than likely kill large numbers of the regime's opponents. But nobody should imagine that the opposition and indeed the revolutionary groups did not exist. I mean, the principal ones were the army, Revolutionary Army of the People, ERP, and the Montoneros, another revolutionary group. And these groups were well-armed, well-organized. They had substantial funding, in part at least from major acts of kidnapping some of the wealthiest businessmen in Argentina and holding them to ransom for millions of dollars. And it was a dirty war, without a shadow of a doubt.
Did the Falklands War change any of that and unify the country behind a cause? Or...
Well, you see, it should be said that the junta, the military government, was successful in crushing these revolutionary groups. It took a number of years, but the methods that they used against them were in the end fairly successful. But the fact that they managed to crush the small extremist groups did not put an end to political opposition inside the country. Indeed, the junta tried to take their foot off the gas, if I can put it that way, to make their regime slightly more liberal, because one of the things they were extremely worried about were the crimes which they had committed in suppressing the revolutionary groups. And they were increasingly worried that if there was a change of government, they themselves, the leaders of the military regime, might find themselves in the dock. And therefore, they tried to liberalize the situation slightly. They were, again, under pressure from the Americans to do so. But the effect of that was actually to light the fires, if you like, of opposition, because people were in the end finally able to demonstrate. They were finally able to publish to some degree their opinions. This caused further, together with, it should be said, economic collapse, which the junta was completely unqualified to deal with, caused a really great instability, which in turn was a contributory factor in the important contributory factor in the junta's decision to seize the Falkland Islands, because this, they believed, would be a unifying move. It would boost their popularity. It would give them a national cause, which they were advancing. And indeed, for a short time, it did precisely that. You had a strange situation that a couple of days before four Argentine troops landed on the Falklands, you had a massive demonstration in front of the Casa Rosada of opponents of the regime, trades unions and others, who filled this very large square with tens of thousands of demonstrators. And then 10 days later, you had an even more massive demonstration in exactly the same location in favour of what the junta had done in seizing the Falklands. So for a brief time, they were able to improve their situation.
One of the things you talk about in the book is the Argentinians getting hold of US military equipment. So how did that happen? And what kind of impact did that have for the Argentinian war effort?
Well, the Americans under Jimmy Carter set out with also a congressional amendment called the Humphrey Kennedy Amendment, put an effective arms embargo on Argentina. We're talking here in the late 70s, while there was evidence that their terrible practices of torture and murder were continuing. Abuses of human rights, as they were called. This certainly had an effect on weakening the Argentine military. The Air Force, for example, was left with defective, or what they believed to be defective, certainly doubtful ejector seats for their pilots, iron bombs, which their Skyhawks were dropping during the war, which were not correctly fused, so quite a number of them didn't go off. That could perhaps be attributed in part to this embargo. But what they did manage to get through the restrictions, and what was absolutely fundamental to the Argentine war effort, and what without which the Argentine war effort probably could not have taken place at all, was they managed to buy two KC-130 refueling, air-to-air refueling tankers. And it's got to be remembered that the Falklands are 500 miles from the nearest Argentine airbase. And the 500 miles return is really the maximum range of many of the Argentine jets, which they then possessed, like, for example, the Mirage, the Israeli modified Mirage, the Dagger, so-called, could literally, of which they had quite a few, could literally make it to the Falklands, but it could only, to have a chance of getting back, They can only spend 5 or 10 minutes there. And that, of course, is no good. So what was absolutely essential were these air-to-air refueling tankers, which, it should be said, could only refuel some of the Argentine aircraft. They couldn't refuel the Dagger, for example, was not capable of air-to-air refueling, and therefore played a very limited part in the war. But what they could refuel were the almost obsolete Skyhawks. Argentina had a number of these jets, which had last seen service in the Vietnam War, and proved to be really the backbone of the Argentine war effort. And they could be refueled air-to-air, and therefore were able to play a very important role. And at the same time, they were able to refuel, the French-built Super Étendard fighter bombers, which carried the Exocet missiles. And the significance of that is not only that it gave the Super Étendards extra range, the range they needed, but also when handled cleverly, which the Argentines did, when the missions of these Super Étendards involved at least two rendezvous with the tankers, it enabled them to fly out to sea on an unpredictable trajectory and come in to on their attacks on the British fleet from unpredictable directions. And that was entirely a function of range. And indeed was another factor which made the air attacks effective, as in the case of the Sheffield and the Atlantic Conveyor. And it's thankful, of course, that the Argentines didn't have more than a handful of air-to-air Exocet missiles, because if they had, the British fleet's position would have been more difficult than it was.
You've mentioned sitting with the sources and finding the name of the person that did this to you, that kidnapped you. Can we talk about these sources? Because you began to, I want to know about working with them. So they came when the US declassified, as you've said, some of the CIA's papers relating to the period. What's it feel like sitting there and dispassionately reading this stuff years later that relates to your own terrifying experience?
Well, it's very interesting. I wish there was more of it, but obviously,
yeah, I mean, you'd be get my answers.
The CIA had more significant things to report on. But yeah. In fact, there are 5 American documents that deal with our kidnapping, I found them all extremely interesting.
So you got his name. What else did you get from them?
The fact that that he was working himself for the 601st Intelligence Battalion, that's yep. In the documents. The fact that we had apparently been under surveillance for several days before this happened, that's mentioned. The fact that, as I mentioned, there was speculation that possible explanation for the kidnapping was this business about the desire to sabotage the peace talks of this small group. That, of course, was very interesting. Really a host of a number of other details.
Did you stay in Argentina?
A couple of days after this happened, Thames Television took the decision that we should be pulled back to London. Quite understandable, because it was not clear whether we were specific targets or indeed what might happen to journalists in any case. But the decision was taken that we should leave, and we left.
Give us a sense of the longer-term impact of this internal war with Argentina on the country today. So the Falklands War itself remains a really sore point for some Argentinians, doesn't it? But what about Galtieri's rule?
Galtieri fell from power almost immediately after the end of the war. He couldn't he couldn't continue. I mean, his policy, he'd lost the war. His policy had been totally discredited. So he had to be replaced. Initially, he was replaced, in the first instance, he was replaced by the interior minister who had been helpful to us. But that only lasted a week or so. For some reason, he was deemed unsatisfactory. And another general then took power. They managed to hang on for about a year before the pressure to return to democracy became irresistible. And since then, there have been a whole succession of democratic governments, one must call them, elected by the people of Argentina, of a variety of political colours, but in general, all of the sort of the liberal, slightly left variety. And certainly not another military regime. But the present situation is interesting in that the Falklands, or as they call them, Las Malvinas, that's no Argentine will talk about the Falklands, they're the Malvinas Islands, are a sacred cause now as far as Argentines are concerned. You know, school children learn about them. There are monuments, there are street signs advertising them. The current president, President Fernandez, has made, though he was not believed to be a militant in this direction, has made a succession of more and more engaged statements about the need to get the Falklands back, or the Malvinas back, as they regard it. He made the most recent of those only a few days ago, which he said, we're not now trying to do this by force. It should be said that the Argentine military is greatly weakened compared to what it was, relatively speaking, in 1982. But we will do it by all diplomatic means possible. And for example, something of significance is that the Chinese government has expressed their support, or its support, for Argentina's position on the Falklands, which is something which may or may not have significance in the future.
Just before we go, this has been an absolutely fascinating interview, and we'll tell everybody how they can find out more. But as a journalist, did it affect the way that you looked at your job after that? What else did you go on to cover?
Well, I mean, one can't say that it enormously affected the way I handled things. One, you know, if you're kidnapped, you don't have a great deal of choice in the matter, if I could put it that way. I mean, one perhaps tries to behave initially a little bit more cautiously, but that doesn't really fly. I mean, you either cover these things or you don't. I went on to do a host of things. In particular, for example, for Thames, I reported what is quite a famous television program, Death on the Rock, about the shooting of these IRA gunmen in Gibraltar. Mm-hmm. And subsequent to that, I joined ITN as a foreign correspondent and spent 5 years in Moscow as a Moscow correspondent, in which I covered what could be regarded as the prototype of the war now taking place in Ukraine, which was the war in Chechnya. I spent a lot of time in Chechnya witnessing the absolute destruction of the capital, Chechen capital, Grozny. And I then spent 10 years in the Middle East as a Middle East correspondent, covering all kinds of matters there, including, of course, the Palestinian dispute, the invasion of Iraq, going to Iran, all kinds of things.
Absolutely fascinating career. Julian, thank you so much for joining us today. The book, Kidnapped by the Junta, is available now. You can buy it on the History Hack bookshop. Please do, because it saves money from going to massive companies like Amazon. It supports local bookstores, it supports Julian, and it supports History Hack as well. Julian, thank you so much.
No problem. Thank you very much yourself.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.